Hi, Kathy.
Hey, how you doing, Ryan?
I am doing great. And I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What are you reading at the moment?
Well, right at the moment, I am reading a friend's book that just arrived yesterday, and I'm so excited about it. It's called Creative Sound Play for Young Learners, and it's by a friend of mine named Hayes Greenfield. And he has this wonderful system for helping transition time, which is the hardest time in school, let me tell you. When kids are moving from gym class to the next class to the next class, they get a little bit rowdy. And he has them using sound, loud and soft, and rhythms to make that period easy for teachers. So I can't wait to read the book he came out with.
And I can almost see a good chunk of our listeners nodding their heads saying, oh, that actually does sound like an interesting book. Listeners, if you're just joining us for this part of the season, we're trying something a little bit new around here on Remaking Tomorrow. Our guest host is Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. And if you're a regular listener, you've actually heard Kathy before. She was with us here in season 5 to talk about making everyday spaces more playful. That's a theme that's definitely going to come up again as we have Kathy here guest hosting. Kathy is the Stanley and Deborah Lefkowitz Professor of Psychology at Temple University, where she directs the Infant Language Laboratory. She is a fellow at the Brookings Institution, at the American Psychological Association, at the American Educational Research Society, and lots of other places. She's published 17 books, more than 250 articles on learning, child development, on parenting, play, and beyond. Her latest book, Making Schools Work, Bringing the Science of Learning to Joyful Classroom Practice, is the first education book co-written with teachers, with administrators, and with scientists, all the kinds of people that we like to talk to on this show. Kathy, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, I just wanted to know who you were talking about. That would sound like I'm really getting around, you know? Anyway, I can't tell you how thrilled I am today to welcome one of the world's experts in reading, because I think everybody's talking about it. We have a reading crisis. There was a podcast that came out in 2022 called Sold a Story.
Oh, yeah.
And oh my gosh, I think it lit the fire under a lot of people who then reignited what, when I was a kid, we used to call the reading wars. And so I thought maybe we should get some clarity about this, and that's why I asked my buddy Susan Newman to join us, because she knows all.
We are so happy to welcome Susan B. Newman, an educator, a research and education policymaker in early childhood and literacy development. She is a professor at New York University. Her interests include early childhood policy, early reading instruction. She previously served as Assistant Secretary of Elementary and Secondary Education for the U.S. Department of Education. And her bio is just as impressive as Kathy's. She's written or edited 12 books. She's written more than 100 peer-reviewed articles on everything from media literacy to early childhood literacy, family literacy, parent education, and more. You can hear that literacy is going to be a big topic of today's program. Susan Newman, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, well, thank you. What a nice introduction.
Well, Susan, you deserve it. You deserve it. I mean, there has to be some clarity out there given what's going on. And I know you co-wrote a Hechinger report where you write, thousands of the nation's students aren't learning to read. And the patchwork of instructional programs, limited resources, frequent change from hybrid to virtual schooling is surely contributing to the problem. Help! Where are we and what's going on?
You know, actually a lot is going on, which is very interesting. I think one of the fascinating things that occurred is as a result of COVID, I think parents all of a sudden said, hey, wait a second, my kid's not learning to read. And he should be able to read. He's fully capable. What's going on? And at the same time, what happened was there was this podcast called Sold a Story. And even before Sold a Story, Emily Hamper was doing a good deal of reporting on reading. So I think both of those issues all of a sudden came at the same time. And people said, wait a second, we have a crisis here. We aren't really improving children's reading, and we should be able to. I mean, it should not be as hard a problem as it's become.
And I think that's why these podcasts and all these headlines suddenly about reading were everywhere. I think it really surprised a lot of people, myself included. And my guess is that a lot of people see these and they think, well, you know, I learned to read in school and maybe it wasn't easy, but I still learned to do it. Can you talk a little bit about what might be different about reading in schools today versus, say, when our listeners were growing up and learning to read themselves?
For one, we have a great deal more research. And that research has really indicated a couple of things, which I think is particularly interesting. One, we know that children really need foundational skills and they need rich content and meaningful experiences to be able to read. At the same time, I think we also have recognized through the disaggregation of data that even schools that presume to be really helping all children weren't helping all children. When we began to look at various subgroups within the school, we found that some students were always being left behind. And that is where we are now, where we're recognizing that we really need to focus more on helping some of the students that have slipped behind and haven't been able to learn how to read.
Yes, this isn't a, I mean, the data were astounding to me. I was looking at the 22 and 23 National Assessment of Education Progress, sometimes called the NAEP results, and it said just 33% of fourth graders met or exceeded proficiency on a test of their reading skills, while 37% of fourth graders performed below the basic level. That is kind of staggering to me, and I get why a whole lot of states, I think we're up to 30-some states now, that have passed legislation to do something about it. But I guess you and I have read this literature for a long time, and we remember the reading wars. Remember in the 1980s and 90s, those reading wars? And why are they back now? I mean, what's the scoop?
Well, I actually think there isn't a reading war now. There was a reading war, and that reading war was all about two different, very different approaches of teaching reading. One was more of a structured kind of reading where there was a good deal of time spent on phonics and mastery learning. I don't know if anybody remembers those terms. And then there was the notion of whole language, where if we provide children with a rich environment, then children should be able to learn and feel joyful in reading. And that was a reading war. And there literally, Kathy, there were people who would go to a conference wearing whole language t-shirts. It was awful. It was terrible. And there was real animosity between the two. I think now what we're seeing is not a reading war. I think we're seeing that there's an acknowledgement that too many children are falling behind, that we've got to make sure that they are catching up, and that we've got to do it using the science of what we know is really important. In our analysis, we're finding, we just finished the 2023 analysis of legislation across the country. And what we're seeing is a great nonpartisan effort among states to really improve their reading for children. And this could be a very, very positive move, moving toward a science. We have to see. You and I know it's all in the implementation.
So that's where I wanted to go for just a sec. So one of the things I'm hearing as I'm talking to state legislators is phonics, 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 phonics. And gosh, we know phonics is important. I mean, I think the brain data is so very clear on this issue. But I don't think that's the whole answer. And I don't know anyone who's more equipped to talk about that than Susan Newman.
Thank you for that. And I think that is one of the misconceptions that we are trying really hard to counter. I think there are some people who just assume that, gee, if we feed students more phonics, that children are going to learn. But one of the things that we know is that oral language development and those early years where parents and children and teachers and children are talking and talking to one another, that talk is so critically important. And many of these laws that we've examined now 332 laws, one of the things that we find missing is all about oral language development and the importance of those early years, as well as rich content knowledge. We need to have our young children engaged in meaningful activity and something that really draws their interest, because those habits that occur in the early years, as you well know, Kathy, will follow you throughout your lifetime. So having children have experiences where they are learning about their world and learning about words to associate the aspects and phenomena in their world is incredibly important. And that is often being left out when we talk about the five pillars of literacy, which are phonics, phonemic awareness, vocabulary fluency, comprehension.
Susan, I love how optimistic you sound. I mean, obviously there are challenges and major challenges, but we ought to underscore the fact that this phrase, the science of reading, is everywhere now. You know, for those of us who've been interested in learning science for a long time, to see it everywhere in headlines and in popular media is really, really exciting. And when you look around at what's happening as a result of all this, at the momentum that the science of reading has behind it now, what's most exciting to you? What are some of the changes you see on the ground, in legislatures? What are some of the more positive trends that make Susan Newman so optimistic?
A number of things. One, I think we have a rich scientific base in reading, and we know how children learn to read. They need basic foundational skills, but at the same time, they need vocabulary and rich content. In other words, we say decoding and language comprehension together equals success in reading. So what we're seeing in the legislation is attention to a good deal of that science, which is really exciting. We're also seeing that teachers are being given some strategies to help them implement that science well. In my view, for example, everything depends on the teacher, the quality of the interaction and the enactment in the classroom. So teachers are being given professional development. They're being given new curriculum, which is based more on the science, not totally. And they're being encouraged to focus on the science of teaching reading, which is different than the science of reading, the enactment. So all of this, from my perspective, is very exciting, potentially exciting. I think there's also an emphasis on making the leadership more aware of what it will take to improve reading instruction. The leadership traditionally have been out in left field. Now they're being embraced more heartily. And then finally, I think that we're also recognizing that family and community supports are a critical part of how children become readers. In other words, children look toward their neighborhood, their family, and they gather ideas and concepts through their neighborhood and through people around them. And so I think we're realizing that relationships really matter.
So you mentioned both in your answer to Ryan and what we were talking about, how important it is to like have conversations about meaningful stuff. And I guess I'd love it if you'd share why having conversations in language is so important to reading. What's the relationship?
One time we thought oral language preceded print literacy, but now we know it's a critical factor in print literacy. So in other words, if children have a rich oral language and engage in a great deal of conversation and talk, when they get to see that word, when they can decode that word, which if you think of it, Kathy, is a relatively straightforward, once you have a little bit of instruction you can do, you now need to know the meaning of that word. And if you haven't had that oral language base, you can't know the meaning of the word. So you can decode it, but you have no language comprehension. That becomes something that we call a word caller. And very often when we get to fifth graders or fourth graders, we have kids who are word callers. They can read every single word, but they don't know what it means. And that becomes a critical factor in comprehension.
That really helps. I'm impressed with the way you said it so simply and so meaningfully. Last night I was on the phone with my grandson, who is just about 7 years of age, and he was reading something a little advanced. So he could actually, you know, spit out, which you call word calling. And then I asked him, what does this story mean? What did you just read to me? And he looked at me with blank eyes like, I have no idea. So I see exactly what you're talking about.
Susan, can you talk a bit more about what all this emerging science of reading means for families? I mean, most of what we see in the media is focused on schools and teachers and classrooms, and I think rightly so. But, you know, I have a 2-year-old at home, and, you know, he can't read yet, but he loves to be read to. What is it that parents and caregivers should be thinking about or doing differently in light of what we're learning about learning to read?
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing in the legislation that's important is actually traditionally when children start falling behind, parents are notified. Well, that doesn't do very much, does it? It only makes you stressed. It makes you worried. It doesn't give you any idea of what to do about it. In much of the legislation we're seeing, they're actually engaging parents in creating reading plans together. That is the recognition that parents are really important, that they deserve to be in from the very beginning. And so I think what we're seeing is a greater recognition of the family as a critical factor in children's education and a great deal more attention to some of the community supports like libraries, some of our nonprofit organizations and how they can help to support the child in after school programming, some playful learning, Kathy, and some other strategies to really help that child, you know, become a successful reader.
So what are you wary about right now? You've been doing all this research, looking at all the legislation, you're hearing what's going on, and finally they're talking about the science of reading.
What worries me is that a lot of the states are beginning to do two things that worry me. One is mandating. I have too much respect for teachers to support mandates. So for example, in New York, and I can just speak primarily about New York, they're mandating curriculum programs, and some of those programs are not appropriate for those children for a whole host of reasons, that the children are doing fabulously well in project-based learning, and then all of a sudden they have to turn to this boring sort of core reading program. So, you know, some of that mandates is scaring the heck out of me because I know teachers well enough, and I know if I'm really doing a good job and I'm being told to do something else, I'm going to find that offensive, frankly, and I'm going to balk. The second thing that worries me is banning. More states are banning certain practices. They're banning certain books that our children are interested in reading, which is, I think, a very negative thing. They're also banning what they call 3Q-ing system. And to me, that is a misunderstanding of what the 3Q was designed to do in the very first place. 3Q-ing was based on the notion that children need graphophonemic skills, they need syntax, which is grammar, they need semantics, which is meaning, and all of those three come together. But it was misinterpreted, and basically some of our colleagues said, well, if two of those systems are working but one isn't, well, that's okay. And we know that's not okay. But to ban a practice is to encourage it in some ways. And that worries me.
Susan, you mentioned a moment ago schools and states banning certain books that children are interested in. And I want to go back to that for a moment because, you know, we talk a lot about the elements of literacy and how reading is taught. I don't want to let go of that thread of how do we get kids interested in reading? How do we get them to love reading, to become lifelong readers? Is there anything in the current research, the current science that suggests, oh, this is something maybe we ought to be doing to encourage more of a love of reading?
Well, I think you raise a wonderful question because that is one of the areas that is missing entirely from legislation, from conversation, from everybody. Children need to be motivated to read. They need a purpose. You know, some of our children, for example, just love informational books. We just did a study where we examined the difference between narrative nonfiction and informational books, and kids, really, the attention was higher with information, and the learning was higher from information books. That's not to say, of course, that narrative is not good, but it is to say that children yearn to learn. I'm afraid that we're not talking about interest or motivation or why should I read? Generally, you read because you want to learn something, you want to find out. And I don't think we're talking about that enough.
So upsetting to me that a lot of kids just don't have that opportunity. You know, there may not be a library nearby, or they may not have a library in the house. And how we help those kids get access is really important.
That's one of the reasons that we became really interested in this term we coined called book deserts, because many of the communities just don't have access to books. And I think it's really important, especially when we think of the summer and when childcare institutions, many of them are closed. Where do children find books in their neighborhood?
You got to talk about the laundromats. You know that.
Yes, yeah, so we put books in laundromats, barbershops, waiting rooms of various kinds, WIC centers. We put them everywhere.
And are they being used?
If children see a book in close proximity to where they're sitting or where they are, they're like toys for children. And I worry, Kathy, that one of the things that we're doing in instruction in school is making it so dry and boring that those books are no longer toys. They're things to be avoided.
Well, if you had to sit there for that long period of time, and literally they're sitting in circle time, right? Like 60, 70% of the time, no wonder they hate reading.
This was interesting. We did an evaluation of libraries all across the country, and a number of libraries are putting in playthings and books. And what we would do is do observations of this. And what we would see is very young children would start playing with a toy and then go and grab a book, hang out with the book for a while, and then they put the book down, they go back to play. And it was like a dance of back and forth from play to book to play to book. And what that showed me is that for young children, books are playful. And that's the way they should be. Mm. It should not be an onerous task for a parent to read to a child or for a child to sit and read on his own. It should be fun. And what that was showing me is from the very beginning, if we begin to pair those fun activities, children will see books as more fun.
So, Susan, we're coming to the end of our time here, and we usually wrap up the program by asking all of our guests one question in particular. Kathy, do you want to do the honors?
Oh, thank you so much. So, Susan, here it comes. What's one thing listeners can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
So I think one of the things that's so critically important, I want to go back to some of the very basic research that we've done over the years, and that is providing access to books. You know, those little libraries are in neighborhoods. And they dot some neighborhoods where you could go from place to place and see different books. And let's get books into the environment of every child all the time. We begin to share with children the importance of not just books, but related activities that connect with books. And so I would like to see that every early childhood setting really focuses on providing access to books, providing people and content that really ensures that children develop words and world knowledge early on.
Susan B. Newman is a professor at New York University. She joins us today on Remaking Tomorrow, which is a podcast powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.